content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the December 4th, 2015 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Trump's escalating anti-Muslim rhetoric. What happened? House Republicans and GOP presidential candidates took strong stands this week against allowing Syrian refugees to enter the U.S., with Donald Trump making a series of incendiary anti-Muslim statements that provoked outrage from both liberals and conservatives. The real estate mogul, who remains far ahead in Republican presidential polls, said that to prevent a Paris-style Islamist attack on American soil, he'd consider closing mosques and creating a database to track the country's Muslims. "We're going to have to do certain things that were frankly unthinkable a year ago," he said. Trump later backtracked, insisting he'd been talking about keeping mosques under surveillance and creating a database of Syrian refugees. The billionaire businessman also said that as president, he'd order security services to waterboard captured terrorists, and repeated the disproved rumor that crowds of Arab Americans in New Jersey openly celebrated the felling of the Twin Towers on 9/11. "It was on television. I saw it," he told ABC's This Week. "I know it might not be politically correct for you to talk about it, but there were people cheering as those buildings came down. No such TV images ever existed." While Trump's GOP rivals did not back his calls for policies targeting Muslims, they did ramp up their rhetoric over the dangers posed by Syrian refugees. Ben Carson compared vetting refugees to protecting children from rabid dogs. Ted Cruz defended his plan to accept only Christians. Chris Christie doubled down on the argument that the U.S. shouldn't accept any Syrian refugees at all, even orphans under the age of five. Meanwhile, 47 House Democrats joined GOP lawmakers to pass a bill requiring each Syrian refugee to be personally signed off by the FBI director, the Homeland Security Secretary, and the Director of National Intelligence. The bill, which would significantly delay the program to resettle up to 10,000 Syrian refugees in the U.S. in 2016, will now go to the Senate. President Obama has promised to veto the legislation if it reaches his desk, saying that refugees already undergo the most rigorous and thorough security screening of anyone. What the editorial said. "Donald Trump is a danger to the Republic," said the New York Daily News. "He is casually throwing around the possibility of steps that would trash the U.S. Constitution, such as shutting down or surveilling mosques and forcing Muslims to carry ID cards. Preying on legitimate security fears in the wake of mass murder in Paris, Trump is dabbling with an abomination." But the more he ratchets up the demented rhetoric, the higher his polls go, said the Newark, New Jersey Star-Ledger. "Since the Paris attacks, Trump's support has increased nationally, up to 32% in one poll, and in key primary states. Rival Republican candidates may fear alienating the conservative base if they attack its hero, but unless they denounce Trump's inflammatory rhetoric, the GOP risks being branded as the party of bigots." "Trump comes from a long, ugly tradition that gave us Joseph McCarthy and George Wallace," said the New York Times. "But Trump has a 21st century advantage in fomenting fear and hatred. He spreads his lies on social media, unfiltered by reporters. In addition to his demonstrably false and libelous claim about American Muslims celebrating 9/11, He tweeted last week a bogus chart claiming that 81% of white murder victims are killed by blacks. In reality, it's 15%. The media should be more aggressive in calling out his lies, racism, and Islamophobia. History teaches that failing to hold a demagogue to account is a dangerous act. What the columnist said. The heart and soul of the Republican Party is in play right now, said Ed Rogers in WashingtonPost.com. There is more anger and fear in the GOP than I have ever seen, stemming from the Obama-led American retreat from around the world, the anemic economy, ruptured race relations, and cultural unease. Trump is ruthlessly tapping those sentiments, and Cruz is following close behind with a similar message. It's turning into a race of hotheads versus everybody else. Think how we Muslims feel, said Dean Obadallah in thedailybeast.com. During a rally deep in the heart of Dixie, Trump said, "I want surveillance of these people." With that chilling phrase, "these people," his message was clear. Muslims are not your fellow Americans. The Donald's presidential run was entertaining at first, but the joke is over. Despite sparking an avalanche of criticism, Trump talks sense on some issues, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. Monitoring mosques would be a sober and focused approach to countering radicalization. And the notion that refugees are potential terror threats is not a figment of Trump's fevered imagination. Actually, the chances of ISIS sneaking a terrorist into the U.S. as a refugee are minuscule, said Peter Bergen in CNN.com. A lottery decides who's selected to apply. The vetting process takes about 2 years and involves biometric scans, travel history checks, and screenings by all the major government security agencies. And only 2% of those accepted are military-age males between 18 and 30. The real danger is the visa waiver program, which allows citizens of countries like France and Belgium, where most of the Paris attackers were from, to visit the U.S. without a visa. Republicans are in denial mode, said Michael Gerson in the Washington Post. With just 2 months until the first primary, many still refuse even to consider the prospect of Trump winning the nomination. But what if he does? The belligerent businessman wants to spark trade wars with China and Mexico, round up and deport 11.5 million people, and turn the GOP into an anti-immigrant party. When will sane and decent conservatives stand up to this bully? We cannot form a coalition with the advocates of an increasingly raw and repugnant nativism. Our controversy of the week, Obama providing the right leadership on ISIS. President Obama misjudged ISIS from the beginning, and even after the bloodbath in Paris, he just can't seem to change, said Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal. The supposed leader of the free world once dismissed the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria as the JV team of terrorism, and declared just days before Paris that the group had been contained. Now he keeps insisting that his half-hearted strategy to combat ISIS is working just fine. At a press conference in Turkey last week, Obama actually referred to the horror in Paris as a setback, said Charles Krauthammer in the Washington Post. Most disturbing, however, was Obama's petulant demeanor. Questions about his failed Syria policy were greeted with weariness and annoyance. He could only muster any passion when sneering at Republicans for their opposition to accepting Syrian refugees, which tells you all you need to know about this president's priorities. 129 innocents lie dead, but it takes the GOP to kindle Obama's ire. Obama's assumptions about ISIS have proven to be wrong, said Robert Kagan in the Wall Street Journal. He thought the group would continue its would confine its barbarity to the Middle East and could be slowly degraded over time by airstrikes and by ground assaults by Kurdish fighters, the Iraqi army, and friendly Sunni tribesmen. But with the slaughter in Paris, the downing of a Russian airliner, and the flood of refugees into Europe from Syria, it's time for a major recalculation. ISIS has grown into an urgent threat to global stability, as well as to U.S. national security, and America will have to take the lead in dealing with it. To destroy ISIS, the U.S. will need to send 10,000 to 20,000 ground troops and another 30,000 to establish safe zones in Syria to keep people from fleeing. Obama's measured strategy may not produce a quick victory, said Kai Bird and foreignpolicy.com, but it's still the smart one. If he succumbed to the facile and demagogic cries for war, U.S. ground forces might defeat ISIS, but they would lose the larger war for the hearts and minds of the Muslim world. Every time we've used military might in the region, it has led to a power vacuum, bitter sectarian struggles, and the rise of new extremist groups fueled by anger at the Crusaders' occupation. The only rational path is to steadily erode ISIS with airstrikes and Arab ground forces, and to block its revenues from the sale of black market oil. It may not be emotionally satisfying to hawkish Republicans, said Ryan Lizza in The New Yorker, but Obama's realism is soundly grounded in U.S. experience in the region. After Paris, though, Obama needs to provide more emotional leadership, said Frank Bruni in The New York Times. The attacks in Paris left many Americans fearful, even panicked. They looked to their president to tell them that he grasped the magnitude of the threat and was intensely focused on it. Instead, Obama chose to mock and belittle his critics while offering condescending assurances that his policy is working. Obama should treat the concerns of frightened Americans with gravity and respect and explain why he's sticking with his strategy, even though the threat from ISIS has clearly evolved. A deeply alarmed nation needs more than peevish lectures from a president weary of criticism, said Greg Jaffe in the Washington Post. ISIS slaughtered Parisians in the streets and is vowing to do the same in the U.S. Why hasn't a man known for his rhetorical gifts done more to address the fear the attacks instill in ordinary Americans? It was a good week for erasing the past after Facebook introduced a feature that allows users to automatically block posts from their exes and remove photos of former couples in happier times. It was a good week for equal time after NBC agreed to give 12 minutes of free airtime to Republican presidential candidates John Kasich, Mike Huckabee, Jim Gilmore, and Lindsey Graham, who had complained Donald Trump got an unfair boost by hosting Saturday Night Live. And it was a good week for reality checks after an analysis by political polling guru Nate Silver concluded that the number of Republican voters who support Donald Trump represents just 6 to 8% of the overall electorate. That's roughly the same number of Americans who believe that the Apollo moon landings were faked. But it was a bad week for conscious consumption after a British study found that roughly 15% of young adults do not know that pork comes from pigs and lamb comes from sheep. Some 20% believe that fish fingers are made from the fingers of fish. It was a bad week for elaborate excuses after an Atlanta college student tried to explain why he missed an exam by forging official documents stating that he was in jail. When his ruse was discovered, Deonta Stevens was arrested and briefly jailed. It was a bad week for downward-facing dogs after the University of Ottawa banned a yoga class on the grounds that the West was engaging in cultural genocide by appropriating an ancient spiritual practice from India. The teacher offered to rename the class Mindful Stretching. We're on the briefing page. A crucial climate summit. More than 190 countries will gather in Paris on November 30th to try to slow climate change. Is it too little, too late? What is the goal of the conference? The main goal of the 21st Conference of Parties is to try to limit the global temperature increase over pre-industrial levels to 2 degrees Celsius, 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. If temperatures rise above that threshold, climatologists say, the damage will be severe. A rise in sea level of at least several feet will inundate many coastal cities, while huge swaths of the world will be subjected to record heat waves, drought, floods, and famine. To avoid this fate, countries would have to collectively slash carbon dioxide emissions below 40 billion tons a year by 2030. Currently, the world is on track to emit roughly 59 billion tons a year by 2030. But with the effects of 1 degree global warming already evident, including altered weather patterns and melting glaciers and sea ice, even reluctant nations like China appear ready to enter into a binding international agreement that would set emissions limits for each country. We're not in a world of business as usual anymore, says UN Climate Chief Cristina Figueres. We're in a world of business as urgent. Why didn't nations act earlier? Cutting emissions required accepting a lot of immediate economic pain for abstract future gain, which human beings resist. In Kyoto in 1997, the delegates secured a legally binding pact to address climate change, but the U.S. Congress refused to ratify the agreement, so it was not binding. A total of 37 industrialized countries did pledge to cut emissions by an average of 5% against 1990 levels by 2012, but 16 of the nations failed to hit their targets. There was a greater sense of urgency at Copenhagen in 2009, but the global financial crisis left countries reluctant to commit to reductions that could dampen economic growth. In the end, delegates were able to come up with only a weak, non-binding commitment to take note of the 2-degree ceiling. The run-up to Paris has been very different. How so? This time around, each of the 195 countries in the EU have been asked to submit a specific individual reduction in emissions they intend to make by 2030. Almost 150 countries thus far have submitted targets with sizable reductions. President Obama has committed the U.S. to a reduction of between 26 and 28% from 2005 levels by 2025. The cuts will be made not by reducing Americans' overall energy use, but by burning far less coal, doubling the amount of electricity generated by solar and wind power, and imposing stricter fuel efficiency and greenhouse gas standards on medium and heavy-duty vehicles. China, which is currently dealing with uncontrollable smog levels in its cities, has pledged that its carbon emissions will peak by 2030 and that renewable energy will account for 20% of electricity consumption by that year. Who could ruin the deal? Poorer, less developed countries that face serious consequences from climate change have threatened to walk out of the conference. They are demanding a pledge from richer industrialized nations to provide $100 billion a year to help them adapt to rising seas and hotter temperatures. An argument is also brewing between France and the Obama administration, which doesn't want the pact to be legally binding. For a binding treaty, the White House would need ratification from the Republican-led Congress, which it almost certainly would not get. Even if delegates did manage to overcome these disputes and secure a universal agreement, the current pledges submitted would still result in warming of between 2.7 and 3.5 degrees Celsius. At best, said Tim Gore of the global charity Oxfam, the conference is seeking an agreement that would only take us from a 4-degree catastrophe to a 3-degree catastrophe. Is 2 degrees a lost cause? Many scientists believe we've already emitted enough greenhouse gases to lock in a 2 degrees Celsius rise, since those gases will continue to have a warming effect for up to a century. And total emissions are likely to continue to rise, with India insisting it has to double its coal production by 2020 to help lift its massive and rapidly growing population of 1.3 billion out of poverty. Barring some technological miracle, we'll probably blow right past it, said climate scientist Ray Pierre Humbert. What then? Some scientists and technologists, including Bill Gates, argue that innovation is our best hope. Researchers could focus on developing an alternative form of energy production that produces no greenhouse gases. Another possibility is carbon capture and storage, a still unproven technology in which power plants pump their carbon emissions into the ocean or underground reservoirs where the gases can't trap the sun's heat. A much riskier enterprise is geoengineering. But given the uncertainty of innovation, the Paris Climate Summit will still be a critical test of the world's seriousness about responding to climate change. The key for Paris, said President Obama, is just to make sure that everybody is locked in, saying, "We're going to do this." Hacking our planet's atmosphere. As climatologists resign themselves to the inevitability of major warming, some are turning their attention to geoengineering, using technology to artificially cool the climate to compensate for the greenhouse effect. One team has proposed erecting a giant mirror in outer space to reflect the sun's rays away from the Earth. Another has suggested covering Greenland's ice sheets in a shiny blanket that would reflect solar radiation. Perhaps the most feasible proposal is to use aircraft or powerful missiles to spray out large quantities of sulfur dioxide particles at high altitude, creating a sulfur cloud that reflects solar radiation. But geoengineering is highly controversial. Some scientists warn that disrupting the enormously complex system we call climate would have unpredictable and potentially catastrophic results. It might get cooler over one continent but hotter elsewhere, while storm and rainfall patterns could change dramatically. Matt Watson, a member of a British team researching geoengineering, admits that it is impossible to predict how intervening in the climate could affect the planet. "Personally, I find this stuff terrifying," Watson said. Moving on to the columns now. Our first is from the U.S. "An enemy unlike any we've fought. The horrific massacre in Paris reminds us of the Achilles heel of American foreign policy," said Robert Samuelson. "Since World War II, the U.S. has spread its influence and values throughout the world largely by offering to bring material progress, freedom, and democracy to other nations. This approach has paid large dividends, transforming Japan and Germany from enemies to prosperous allies, triumphing over communism, and turning much of Asia into market economies and trading partners. But today we face foes who repudiate our faith in the power of shared prosperity. Putin's Russia has chosen aggressive nationalism over the Pax Americana, despite great economic costs. Radical Islam, meanwhile, emphatically rejects material progress and secular democracy and promotes a moral code and fanatical religious dogma that is utterly foreign to Western values. ISIS and other Islamic radicals couldn't care less about giving their followers better material lives. Instead, they promise religious purity and paradise and glorify murder and martyrdom, disdaining Western freedoms and material wealth as vulgar and evil. We're fighting people whose worldview is incomprehensible, and the battlefield has become selected by them. That's why this struggle is so disorienting. This column's from Greece, clinging to a leftist fantasy. Spoiled, complacent Greece could learn a few things from its former Eastern Bloc neighbors, said Alexis Papakilis. Greece drives off potential foreign investors, belittles its allies, and takes its membership in NATO and the European Union as an inalienable right. It still has not enacted vital economic reforms, despite multiple bailouts and loans, not to mention threats from creditors. Contrast this behavior with that of Albania or Macedonia or other ex-Yugoslavian countries. Since the collapse of communism, they have embraced capitalism and political reform and are succeeding at both. They see Europe and the U.S. as natural allies and aspire to become members of all the closed international clubs we have belonged to since the 1950s. What's the difference between us? These formerly communist nations reject the failed leftist model because they actually experienced it, while we maintain it as an artificial chimera. Somewhere in our psyche, a socialist workers' paradise is still felt to be achievable, and that's why we won't dismantle our bloated bureaucracy or make the labor laws more business-friendly. One can only hope that at some point the competitive Greek instinct and pride will kick in. When we see ourselves lagging behind Macedonia, maybe then we'll get serious about reform. And one from Indonesia, how China outsourced deforestation. It's too easy to blame Indonesia alone for the smog engulfing Southeast Asia, said Venka Ambumotsi. Yes, the forest fires sending vast plumes of choking smoke across Malaysia and Singapore are burning on Indonesian territory. And yes, the fires have been set on purpose to clear land for palm oil plantations. But why are so many Indonesians turning to palm oil production? And why does the government see the industry as so vital to the economy that it does little to curb their spread of the spread of the farms? Palm oil is highly lucrative because the countries that use it the most, China and India, don't produce nearly enough for their needs. And they can't produce more because they have little agricultural land to spare. And their already smog-choked populations won't tolerate more air pollution from slash-and-burn farming. So, in effect, these countries have decided to export their deforestation to Indonesia. It may seem bizarre or even far-fetched to implicate someone morally by their purchasing habits. But as long as Chinese and Indian demand for palm oil remains high, efforts to stamp out Indonesia's forest fires are doomed. Indonesia is responsible for the fires, but the world should consider the outside forces encouraging this burning. We're on the last word, and it has a disturbing title, and I'll have to admit that I haven't pre-read the article, so if you're willing, we'll just go in together. how to transplant a head. An Italian surgeon hopes to perform the first ever head transplant, said Tom Lamont. Is he a genius or a crank? Outside a large concrete hospital in Turin, Sergio Canavero is trying to persuade a pair of security guards to let us use the staff car park. Allora, he begins, explaining to the guards that he used to be employed at the hospital as a surgeon in the neurology department and is back for a visit. At the end of his speech, he moves a stiff hand across his neck, a cutthroat gesture that would represent a threat if made by almost anyone else. The guards grin in recognition and wave us through. I told them I'm the guy who's going to do the first human head transplant, Canavero tells me. Italians are suckers for a celeb. Earlier this year, Canavero became famous around the world when he enlarged on plans, long cherished, to remove the heads of two people. One would be alive, with an ailing body, a paraplegic, say. The other newly dead or doomed, perhaps the brain-dead victim of an accident. As Canavero explained in academic papers and speeches, he planned to surgically attach the first head to the second body, fusing the spinal cord so that the owner of the first head might enjoy the functional use of the second body. It might be best understood as a body transplant, but the wider world has tended to settle on the more sensational phrase. Head transplantation, body transplantation, whatever, Canavero says as we walk around the busy hospital. Technicality. He once thought the first head transplant would be performed at the hospital in Turin. Canavero came here as a medical student in the 1980s and was employed on the wards for much of his professional life. Then he went and caused the brouhaha, as he now calls it, publishing papers on head transplants in the medical journal, Surgical Neurology International, giving TED Talks in Limassol and Verona, making headlines, becoming that celeb. Canavero says the Italian medical establishment turned against him. Last February, he and the hospital that had employed him for so long agreed to rescind his contract. I've become a pariah, he says, making sure I notice the frosty reception he receives from some of his former colleagues in the neurology department. You see, no hugs. So he has had to look abroad for somewhere to stage his surgery. He tells me that after lengthy negotiation, it will take place in China, in the northern city of Harbin. The Harbin Institute of Technology will provide assistance, as will Harbin Medical University, which has made him an honorary professor in anticipation. With the Chinese providing the hospital and personnel, his operation will be ready to go sooner than anybody might have expected, as early as Christmas 2017, he thinks. Canavero has a very clear picture of this surgery in action, having outlined it in two TED Talks, in a keynote address last summer at an American conference of neurosurgeons, and in a new book, Il Cavello Immortale, The Immortal Brain. He describes it to me in detail. The operating theater of the near future, where two bodies will be clamped tight in special frames. One will be the anesthetized patient, the other a brain-dead donor. Using either a specially fashioned diamond microtomic snare blade or a nano knife made of a thin layer of silicon nitride, he isn't sure yet, the bodies will be severed at the neck between the C5 and C6 vertebra. Then the frames that are clamping the two bodies will begin to separate, their upper arms rotating and taking the two heads with them. The patient's head will be deposited atop the donor's body. Next, a marathon of surgery, somewhere between 36 and 72 hours long and requiring a crew of 150 medics. About 80 of them, Canavero thinks, will need to be surgeons. At first, it will be expensive, around $17 million, he guesses, admitting that private sponsors are still needed. Later, as the technique gets perfected, the cost will be slashed. In the operating room, those 80 surgeons will relay in and out as expertise dictates. The head body arteries will be joined first so that blood recirculates around the brain. As for the other connections required, windpipe, gullet, spine, everything that links a human's head to the rest, Canavero says he will stand aside until it comes to the spinal cord. Functional neurosurgery, or that relating to the movement, is his field. If his patient is to regain movement after the operation, some of the millions of nerves that exist inside the two spinal cords will need to connect. Canavero has novel ideas about ways to sprout such connections during the surgery, including delivering small electrical shocks to the spinal cord at the point of fusion, and by flushing in a substance called polyethylene glycol, or PEG, something he believes will supercharge the process. Not all the nerves in the spine will need to regrow and join, Canavero thinks, for the patient to regain some movement. Just, say, 10 to 20% of them. After the operation, the patient will be kept in a coma for about 3 weeks, in part to inhibit movement, then rehab, months of it. Canavero expects this will involve some kind of virtual reality simulator to help the patient acclimatize to the unfamiliar body. There might be hypnosis. Afterward, he anticipates recovery, a press conference, and, why not, a Nobel Prize. It will be much more than landing on the moon. I'm pretty sure about that. This will be the greatest revolution in human history, if it pans out as I expect it to. One very tangible piece of the plan is in place. At the meeting of American surgeons last summer, Canavero announced a man named Valery Spiridonov, a 31-year-old graphic artist from Russia. Spiridonov has severe muscular atrophy and has been a wheelchair user all his life. Spiridonov has volunteered whenever Canavero is ready to be a test patient. The first guy to go under the microtomic knife. I call him Gagarin, Canavero says. Head transplants have been attempted before, on Russian puppies in the 1950s, on an American monkey in the 1970s, on hundreds of Chinese mice between 2013 and 14. The puppies live less than a week, the monkeys just over that. The mice tended to linger about a day. But in all of those cases, proof of concept was the aim, less so patient survival. It is a regrettable truth that the very little innovation takes place at the sharp scalpel end of the medicine without a lot of animals getting killed first. Heart transplants, kidney transplants, all were based on years and years of animal work, said the eminent British neurosurgeon Henry Marsh. Many of those who are skeptical about Canavero's scheme, Marsh among them, have wondered, where are his carcasses? Canavero tells me he is morally opposed to experiments on animals. I don't want to kill any more animals. We've killed enough. We don't need more animal data. He believes the necessary research for his surgery has already been done. In disparate studies over a century, he says, not just those experiments on puppies, monkeys, and mice. Canavero has dug up papers relating to an American woman in 1902 who had her spinal cord severed by a gunshot. Also a skier, similarly injured in an accident on the slopes in 2005. In both cases, the patient's spines were successfully refused by surgeons with recovery of limited movement. Canavero remembers reading in a newspaper about the head transplant attempted on a monkey and immediately thinking about being the first to perform such surgery on a human. He was poor at the time, his upbringing rough. It steeled me, he says. My father told me, either your grades are good or you go to work. I was best in class at the end of elementary school. At the end of junior high, excelente. He enrolled in medical school and within a couple of years was submitting papers to academic journals. In the mid-1980s, he moved to the hospital in Turin and began to train as a functional neurosurgeon. What did his peers make of him back then? "I've always been a loner," he says. But he had friends. Of course, from time to time you interacted. I would stick to that word. I interact when I have to learn, and then I go my way. You can only go alone on such a path. Canavero is aware of his idiosyncrasies. "I'm not normal," he says. "I have no problem admitting that. Even if I didn't, you would probably notice, right? You'd sense something, perhaps." At one point, he seizes me by the neck to demonstrate a jiu-jitsu chokehold. Later, he cheerfully describes winning his wife away from another man who was taller, as well as several influential medical papers. He once published a book, Donne Scoperte, Women Uncovered, that outlined his tried and tested seduction techniques. "I'm not really a feminist, so sorry to the girls." Canavero likes to talk about medical pioneers who were outcast and fringe dwellers in their day. Louis Pasteur, he says, was called crazy for suggesting illnesses could be caused by microbes. The history of mankind is trial and error, but we have to be dreamers. If you don't dream, you're not going anywhere. Society's challenge, Canavero thinks, is to tease apart the kooks from the super kooks. And maybe you can only know that after the caper. It is a theory echoed by Spiridonov, the man who's offered the risk his life to be Canavero's first patient. "Some people are geniuses, and some people are cranks," he says, "and you might never know before the project is finished." I ask about China's involvement in all this. Canavero has said that he's committed to the procedure being open to the public view at all stages, scrutinized. I point out that China isn't famous for that. "China's China. The media is state controlled, but China will want you to know about this just to spite the West." He admits suddenly that in all likelihood, Spiridonov won't be the first patient to undergo the procedure. Actually, he will not be the absolute number one. Probably the Chinese will want to do that on a Chinese patient. Canavero expects it will be somebody with terminal cancer, someone with minimal life expectancy, in order to test it, like Apollo 10. Valerie will be Apollo 11. If Spiridonov recovers, gets used to his new body, and goes on to have children, whose children will they be? Not his, Canavero says. That's the only ethical question you might ask. But imagine, you have a child, and this child one day is involved in a car crash, brought to the hospital, declared brain dead, there's nothing that can be done. But now imagine this. I'm the doctor on call. I come down and tell you, for the brain of your child, I have no solutions. But if you grant me his or her body, one day that body with a new head will reproduce. And those children will be your grandchildren. Life will not end. When it comes to the implications of all this, Canavero doesn't really consider them to be his problem. Scientifically, what can be done will be done. All he feels obliged to do is encourage other people to ponder the implications. If we are to live longer, for instance, what about overpopulation? He guesses we'll have to think about conquering other planets. When I ask how there will be enough bodies to support all the transplants, he says, cloning will come into play. I must show my exasperation because he looks at me with concern. I know it's hard, he says. It's hard to swallow. I understand that. It's crazy. Sometimes when I look at it, I say, will mankind be able to handle this? I don't know. But society must prepare itself for a major tectonic shift. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in The Guardian. On the Health and Science page, Earth's vast tainted groundwater reservoir. The amount of groundwater lying just beneath just beneath the Earth's surface is vastly larger than previously thought. But almost none of it is of any use. Until recently, scientists based their estimates for the Earth's total groundwater, water that seeped underground and became trapped in tiny spaces between rock, sand, and soil, on crude calculations made in the 1970s. But now, using data from more than 1 million watersheds and 40,000 groundwater models, hydrologists have estimated that there's as much as 6 quintillion gallons of water in the upper 1.2 miles of the Earth's crust. If that water were pumped out and spread across the continents, it would form a layer 600 feet deep. Unfortunately, almost all of this groundwater is old, salty, and contaminated with arsenic and uranium, making it useless to the 2 billion people living in arid regions who'd rely on wells and springs for fresh water. Just 6% of groundwater stores are younger than 50 years old, drinkable, and renewable within a human lifetime, a smaller, more finite supply than previously estimated. The researchers say their findings could help governments better manage their groundwater reservoirs amid rising global demand. We're using our groundwater resources too fast, faster than they're being renewed, the study's lead author, Tom Gleason, tells CSMonitor.com. We want to find out how long before we run out of this critical resource. Drink coffee, live longer. Many people rely on big cups of Java to power them through the working day. But a coffee habit may have another benefit, reducing your risk of premature death, reports CBSNews.com. In an analysis of 3 long-term surveys charting the drinking habits of more than 200,000 men and women, scientists found those who drank moderate amounts of coffee, 3 to 5 cups a day, were up to 15% less likely to die from neurological diseases, type 2 diabetes, and even suicide. The benefits were limited to non-smokers, but were the same for both decaf and regular coffee drinkers. It's unclear why coffee seems to reduce the risk of premature death. Scientists suspect that the naturally occurring nutrients in coffee beans, such as magnesium and chlorogenic acid, likely play a role, because they have been shown to reduce insulin resistance and systemic inflammation. Caffeine also appears to boost mood and reduce the risk of depression. Whatever the explanation, the study adds weight to previous research showing that moderate consumption of coffee can be beneficial to health. Associations are not proof of causation, cautions Alice Lichtenstein, a spokeswoman for the American Heart Association. However, the data on the topic have been very consistent over the years. On the Talking Points page, GMO salmon headed for the dinner table. Genetically modified salmon may be swimming upstream to a store near you, said Emily Willingham in Forbes.com. After a 20-year vetting process, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has given the green light to Aqua Advantage salmon, the first genetically modified food from animals approved for human consumption. Dubbed Frankenfish by critics, it's a behemoth version of the Atlantic salmon that has been engineered to grow faster and larger than typical farm-raised fish. Researchers at Massachusetts-based Aqua Bounty Technologies combined genes from the easy-to-farm Atlantic salmon and the much larger Chinook salmon, and then added a gene from another fish, the ocean pout, that operates like an on switch to growth. Voila, a super salmon. The FDA says its rigorous review concluded that the modified fish are safe to eat and nutritionally identical to unmodified salmon. But the Aqua Advantage salmon will likely face a tide of pushback from opponents of genetically modified anything. When this fish reaches the stores in a couple of years, buy it, said bioethicist Arthur Kaplan in NBCNews.com. We are overfishing salmon, and this valuable fish may become extinct if we don't stop eating so much. The genetically modified salmon will provide food to a hungry planet needs, and requires about 25% less food than wild salmon, another win for the planet. Many environmentalists and other opponents warn that the superfish will escape into a river and cause mayhem, said Nick Stockton in Wired.com. They might start competing for resources with their wild cousins, for example, or start interbreeding with them. But Aqua Advantage salmon have been placed in species-wide solitary confinement, grown only in above-ground freshwater tanks in Panama. And even if the fish could break out of the tanks, their creators made sure they can't breed. They're all sterile females. If genetically modified salmon is so wonderful, said Tamar Haspel in the Washington Post, why not label it? The company has no intention of using a GMO label, and the U.S. government doesn't require labeling any GMO foods. One of the reasons GMOs became such a brouhaha is that consumers feel the technology was foisted in secret on an unsuspecting public. Instead of being sneaky and cowardly, the FDA should give consumers an informed choice about what kind of salmon they're buying and let everyone, pro and con, vote with their wallets. HIV, the outing of Charlie Sheen. Did a time machine come and whisk me away, said Tim Tiemann in thedailybeast.com. It sure felt like 1985 again last week when Charlie Sheen came out as HIV positive on NBC's Today Show, and his confession was met with a wave of judgmental speculation about the actor's lifestyle choices, including his prolific sex life. Sheen has been smoked out of the closet by the National Enquirer, which was preparing a salacious 8-page special about Sheen's AIDS cover-up, wrongly conflating being HIV positive with having the disease. If that wasn't proof enough of the stigma that still surrounds HIV, former TV co-star Jenny McCarthy ignorantly implied Sheen could have spread the virus through kissing. We've just witnessed a hideous throwback to a time before we knew better, said Rachel Feltman in the Washington Post. Apparently, we still prefer to believe that HIV is something dirty and dangerous that only dangerous, dirty people get. Sheen is hardly some courageous victim, said John Moir in the Daily Mail. The actor was diagnosed more than 4 years ago, but carried on living his car crash life, pedal to the metal, potentially exposing wives, lovers, and hundreds of sex partners and prostitutes of both genders as he did so. Sheen claims to have led with condoms and honesty, but a number of unsuspecting women have said this wasn't the case, including former live-in lover Bree Olson. Despite all Sheen has been through, said Deborah Orr in TheGuardian.com, he still seems utterly unable to take responsibility for his own actions. With HIV still such a fraught issue, let's not make Sheen the role model he plainly isn't ready to be. Sheen's confession should serve as an HIV wake-up call, said Mariel Garza in LATimes.com. Too many people complacently assume the virus is something that only afflicts gay men or those living in third world countries. But HIV still kills 13,000 people a year in the U.S. alone, and about one quarter of the 50,000 new cases a year are transmitted via heterosexual sex. True, HIV is no longer the death sentence it once was. In fact, many people, including Sheen, are living long and relatively healthy lives with medication. But to keep the virus at bay, they must take powerful antiretrovirals every day for the rest of their lives. HIV is still a serious scourge. And a few shorter notes. Of the 68 people who have been indicted in the U.S. in connection with ISIS, 3 were refugees or asylum seekers. None came from Syria. About 80% were U.S. citizens. For the first time in four decades, more Mexican immigrants returned to their home country in recent years than entered the U.S. Between 2009 and 2014, an estimated 870,000 Mexicans came to the U.S., while about 1 million went back to Mexico, a net reduction of 130,000. Law enforcement officers took more property from Americans last year than burglars did. Under civil forfeiture laws, authorities seized $5 billion in property. Burglars took $3.5 billion worth. Over on the poll watch, 57% of Americans disapprove of the way President Obama is handling ISIS. Asked if they would trust Hillary Clinton or a Republican presidential candidate to handle the threat of terrorism, Clinton topped Donald Trump 50% to 42%, Marco Rubio 47% to 43%, and Jeb Bush 46% to 43%. 56% of Americans oppose allowing Syrian refugees into the U.S., while 41% favor granting them asylum. I've got time for a couple of quotes today. The first from Fred Rogers. "The world is not always a kind place. That's something all children learn for themselves, whether we want them to or not. But it's something they really need our help to understand." And finally, from Isaac Asimov, "Never let your sense of morals get in the way of doing what's right." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.